March, as we know, is Women's History Month, and in the world of classical music, one of its most notable figures is Clara Schumann, a serious composer, a distinguished concert soloist, and influential teacher, wife of composer Robert Schumann, and mother of seven children, who had a significant professional career after Robert's death. But this is more a story of Johannes Brahms and his relationship with the women in his life, and something of what such relationships might reveal about his music making. It has long been known that Brahms and Clara Schumann had a deep, abiding, and complex relationship. Brahms biographer Jan Swafford tells us, after a protracted decline, Robert Schumann died in 1856, whereupon Brahms and Clara were free to declare their passion, to marry. The couple went on holiday to Switzerland to sort it all out. Exactly what he said to her, we will never know, but it amounted to this. Cheerio, I'm off to Hamburg, write if you get work. Clara put him on the train, staggered home, and told her journal, I felt as if I were returning from a funeral. Hans Gall picks up the tale in Johannes Brahms, his work and personality, and writes, scarcely 2 years after his flight from Clara, there occurred the only occasion when Brahms almost got as far as walking down the aisle. Agathe von Siebold, the pretty young daughter of a professor in Göttingen, got him to exchange engagement rings with her. Like most of his later flames, Agathe was a singer. It appears that a beautiful voice, like a beautiful human figure, an expression Brahms was fond of using, was irresistible for him. In those days, Brahms frequently visited Göttingen, where his friend Grimm was music director, and the close relationship between Brahms and Agathe became so noticeable that Clara, who had stopped over in Göttingen to visit friends, departed precipitously, and without taking leave, as soon as she became aware of this intimacy. She must have felt bitterly hurt at the time. Indeed, a year later she had nothing but reproaches for his indiscretion. I spent some difficult days in Kassel, she wrote to him, and the thought of Agathe and of a great many other things kept haunting me. I could see the poor, abandoned girl before me, and lived through all her sufferings with her. Oh, dear Johannes, if only you had not allowed things to go that far. Her opinion was undoubtedly shared by others. The affair had become small-town gossip. It seems that Grimm had tried to exert some gentle pressure on his friend, with the result that Brahms brusquely broke off the engagement. What he wrote to Agathe, with exaggerated expression of feeling and at the same time pain-inflicting egoism, does not ring true, but reading between the lines, one detects panic. I love you. I must see you again, but I am incapable of bearing fetters. Please write me whether I may come again to clasp you in my arms, to kiss you, and to tell you that I love you. Grimm, who as music director in Göttingen had to listen to all the prattle at close range, was embittered, and the immediate result was a discord, fortunately of short duration, between the two friends. Later, Agathe was happily married, and Brahms never saw her again. But he did confer immortality upon her. One of his most important works of this period, the G major string sextet, bears her name like a motto in a subsidiary theme in its first movement, a motif based on the letters of her name. Many years later, this theme was mentioned again by Joseph Joachim, the first interpreter of this sextet, in a letter from Göttingen thanking Brahms for his German folk songs. In no place could I have been more receptive to the wonderful folk songs which you have given us than in this town, which brings back such lovely memories. I have read through the songs many times, and I also went over them with Agata. Here he cites her motif in musical notation, for whom I ordered a copy. And Josef Gensbacher, one of Brahms' closest friends at the time of the sextet, remembers a remark he made about the subject. Here is where I tore myself free from my last love. Oddly enough, Brahms' biographers have overlooked the fact that earlier he had used the same theme elsewhere, but in the light of what we know about Brahms, with words certainly significant, it can be found in the 10th of his 12 Songs and Romances for Women's Voices, Opus 44, which Brahms had composed for his Hamburg singers to the words of Paul Heiser Jungbrunnen. It is a piece of soul-searching depth and expressive force, but at the same time of great simplicity in form and diction. The Agata theme recurs as an ostinato figure in the alto part at the words, "When passing through the churchyard, you'll see an open grave where tearfully they buried a lovely broken heart. The gravestones cannot tell you what cause it had to break, but soft the zephyr whispers, 'Twas love that was too great.'" John Swofford continues, "Brahms understood himself and his divided nature with unsentimental clarity. He was a classicizing romantic, a loner who was a creature of the musical mainstream, a backward-looking artist who anticipated and inspired the future of music. Brahms scorned women and loved them and fled from them, but inescapably needed them. Whatever the chaos in Brahms' mind, chaos, his own word, describing his feelings as a teenager, he negotiated his life with extraordinary discipline, common sense, integrity, and honesty. The chaos of emotion shackled and subdued by a relentless sense of form and discipline. That is Brahms' art in a nutshell. Likewise, his life, and the most familiar and beloved note in his art is the note of yearning." That from biographer John Swofford, writing in The Guardian in April 2003, an essay titled In Bittersweet Symphonies. No matter whether we know the composer's story that serves as a biographical basso ostinato in this song, and the string sextet in G major as well, we can't not be touched by the mastery of Brahms and his art. And if we let our imagination wander through this cemetery here in the poem Brahms has set, we might just see in our mind's eye rows of the noble and ancient cypress tree, so often associated with mourning at the passing of the dearly departed, or in this case, at the burying of the broken heart, but also connecting in their erect and dignified way with the sky above and the sense of the immortal that that implies. As it happens, the esteemed Cyprus String Quartet has made this its last recording, having celebrated its 20th season in 2016. We're told, as for repertoire, the choice was clear. These monumental string sextets of Brahms, with their warmth and reflective qualities, are perfectly suited to saying farewell. Cyprus Quartet invited two longtime friends and collaborators to work with them, violist Barry Schiffman and cellist Zul Bailey, and they made the recording live in front of a studio audience at Skywalker Sound Studio in their home state of California. Over the years, we've been fortunate to talk with members of the Cyprus Quartet about their recordings, the complete Beethoven cycle, for example, and now, at this valedictory time, we were also able to speak with cellist Jennifer Kletzel about the Brahms project.
When you talk about the monumental works that there are for strings, I mean, Beethoven quartets for sure, and Brahms, all of Brahms' string chamber music, you know, that's included in there too. So for us, I mean, it was a great honor to be able to spend so much time. We had been performing the sextets for seasons before we decided to record them. And so it kind of naturally occurred that it was like, we want to do this because we'd been performing the two works together. And so we had a very close relationship with those two. And, you know, obviously we get a little obsessed, maybe. Your listeners might have realized that because we, you know, recorded all the Beethoven quartets and we're really playing them a lot in cycles. Same thing, having the two sextets back to back with each other, then you can really look at something up close, learn about the differences. Why was Brahms so drawn to this form? You know, answering all those questions is what part of what makes music fascinating to me.
We know that Brahms was someone who was certainly aware of the tradition, Palestrina and the Baroque and so forth. And so when you come to and have been sharing with us over the years the Brahms, what will we hear in these pieces that might be reflective of that sense, his sense of the tradition in its full sense?
Well, I think what's amazing to me about Brahms, and Brahms was, you know, considered old-fashioned often during his lifetime. At the same time, sometimes when people are looking, when they have a foot in each world, so he's looking back, but he's also paving the way for the future. And I see it in both aspects. Because if you look, for example, just the form of the sextet. So before Brahms's time, I mean, if we look back, who wrote sextets? Well, Boccherini, maybe? I mean, Brahms maybe knew those pieces, but really, I think that, you know, Brahms decided he wanted to, this is the first sextet, was the first piece of chamber music for just strings that he wrote, the Opus 18. And then 4 years later, he returns to the form again. And then from that point forward, so Brahms wrote these two very successful, very wonderful pieces, Dvorak, Schoenberg, Tchaikovsky, Korngold, Schulhoff, people, composers from that time forward, are going to write for string sextet, right? I think that they all discovered, because of Brahms's love of this, that, you know, that it's a little unusual to have a balanced two violins, two violas, two cellos, and that it gives you more symphonic options for texture and enables you to use lower voices as melodic rather than just as bass instruments. And then the power, if you put both bass instruments down on the bottom, what that does for it. So I think he was really exploring expressive possibilities. And so he's looking back and forward for that. So harmonically, he may be moving more forward. Expressively also maybe moving more forward. But there is that nod to before. And the first sextet, I think, has more in common with, there are moments in there that sound much more like Schubert or like Mozart. And we feel that when you're performing it as well. The opening of the last movement, for example, feels to me every time I play it like, oh, Is this Schubert? Is this Mozart? You know, like those Prussian quartets from Mozart that are really high for the cello feels that same way. It's different in the second sextet. It's a little more, he's a little more rooted, I think, in the romantic yearning era.
You mentioned Schoenberg, and didn't Schoenberg even come out as someone who said that Brahms was not an old fuddy-duddy?
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. I think people, you know, great composers can recognize that too. But I think, you know, Brahms really suffered with not being confident about his art for so long. If you think about the fact that at this period of time, when he was in his 20s and 30s, he wrote something like, he made 20 attempts at writing a string quartet, which all of which were discarded. And it's going to be much later that he'll finally come to the quartet form and publish three of them. But at this point, he had that, you know, the ghosts of Mozart and Beethoven looking over his shoulder. And it's amazing to think about this phenomenal composer feeling insecure in that way. But it's also, I think, what drove him to search even, you know, or dig even deeper into himself to find the right expression for himself.
We had a regional orchestra here just doing Brahms Symphony No. 4, and so the conductor was here, and we had a discussion about Brahms and how his first instrument wasn't strings.
No, not at all. Yeah.
Do you get a sense of that when you play through these?
Well, there are things that are certainly awkward for the instruments, but that's the same in Beethoven, too. I mean, I love to look beyond that because I'm not like, oh, Brahms, you silly pianist, you don't know how to write for cello. that never occurs to me in that way. Sometimes, you know, I feel like it's my job to look beyond the difficulty. Or as I remember coaching a group, a string quartet, who was complaining about how hard the music was that they were playing. And we said, well, you know what? Music is hard. It's hard to play. It's hard to capture exactly as you want. And that's our job, to make it seem as easy and seamless as possible. So, yes, I think that he... You know, and I think Brahms even felt like he wasn't sure he knew how best to write for strings. But we are lucky that he had his close friend, the violinist Joseph Joachim, who would look over a lot of this. And he sent the first sextet, to Joachim to try it out. And Joachim had a lot of suggestions for him, including, apparently, there was the Opus 18 sextet began with the first violin had the solo, the main melody. And Joachim said to him, no, put this in the first cello first, and that's how it actually ended up being published. So the first cello has it, and then the violin comes in and has it second. So I think he was making him sort of work even harder to use all the instruments. And Joachim was impressed enough that he arranged a premiere of the work, and Clara Schumann was there for that, and she said something like, it was even more beautiful than I had imagined, and already my expectations were high.
And so tell us about some of those marvelous cello moments that you have, because you have some wonderful featured things there.
That's right, especially in the first sextet, it's a lot of exposed writing for the first cello. In the second sextet, it's more balanced between the first viola, first violin, and first cello, I think. And he was maybe experimenting with that. But it's, you know, it's a legendarily hard piece to pull off and not get too nervous while playing the B-flat sextet. But that's noble work, as I like to say. We have to just, you know, do our very best and hopefully capture what Brahms meant. And it's so expressively beautiful, the range that he uses on the instrument. And then how often the first cello dives back down to be with the second cello, whether we're playing in octaves together or playing the exact same material together, which gives a real power to the bottom of a string ensemble.
And you mentioned having the choice and that you really wanted to record these because you've been living with them, as you suggest. Our listeners will know by the time we introduce this the significance, the farewell nature of this recording. And the second sextet actually has a farewell element in it that is biographical.
It does. That it surely does. And actually, I was thinking about that just this morning, that as this is our farewell project, and the fact that Brahms did put in the letters A-D-E in the first movement where he's saying farewell. Now, he's saying farewell to his love, Agata, whose name he also put as a cipher in that piece. But still, there is something where he's working something out. It's very cathartic. He's saying goodbye to this love. We were, you know, saying goodbye to our group and our recorded sound. So I think those match up. I like to think of it that way.
All the while knowing that if we didn't know either of those facts in the real world, that this music would be, again, masterful on its own.
Yes, I believe in that. I mean, you don't need to know the backstories. For me, I love the backstories behind music and the performers and things, because it just draws it even closer and makes it more personal. However, I think everybody, you know, you close your eyes, you have that personal experience with the music, you're going to feel something. I mean, this music will sweep you away. I mean, that's just the nature of these sextets and how they're written.
You had the choice. You could have done another quartet album as the finale, but you invited dear friends to be with you. Could you introduce our listeners to your colleagues?
Sure. So we've had a long, long, long and fruitful collaboration with these two artists separately and together. So the person we chose to play second viola on the album is Barry Schiffman. And Barry was a colleague of ours as just down the road in Stanford in the St. Lawrence Quartet. So we had known him for a long time. He now is in Toronto. And we had performed with him quite a bit. And then Zool Bailey, I actually grew up in the same region with Zool. We studied with the same teachers. We all had, you know, friendships with him, and then started performing with him a lot and going to festivals that he runs. So when the group kind of came together, there was something that really sealed about this group, because also Zool, who's a phenomenal cellist, and Barry, who's an amazing violinist and violist, they had actually had a relationship before together in college. And so everything just clicked. And clicked sort of beautifully. And so it made sense to do this. I mean, there were plenty of other string quartet recordings we would have liked to have made, but this felt right. And sometimes you have to just go with what feels right.
We know how special you all are, and that's why this is such a bittersweet conversation. And maybe we'll have a chance to talk to you about other projects. And of course, that's something we can look forward to. But you all have these special occasions for your audiences, and you have a very distinctive relationship with them. And so you not only had Zool and Barry, but you have an audience that's part of this experience as well, because
right.
That's so characteristic of who you all are.
Right. Well, and the way we looked at it, it was a very intimate experience. So we were friends playing with friends for friends, and it just happened to be recorded, right? So that's sort of the way we looked at it. And so that, I mean, if you look at it from one angle, it puts more pressure on it. On another angle, it actually doesn't. It just creates kind of a magical experience. And the people that were in the room, and they were actually in the recording studio with us on the scoring stage, the 40 or 50 people. And we did it 2 days in a row where they got to hear the complete, you know, playthrough of each of the pieces. And we had lunch with them in between. And there was a question answer session afterwards. So, you know, that was all part of it. I mean, they were really there and they were part of the experience. And we were not only capturing this digitally, but we also had a reel-to-reel team in there. So we captured it in analog as well. That'll be released later for those people who are those audiophiles who have those wonderful machines. So you can hear it in analog, which is, it's a different sound. It's warmer and lusher. It was kind of a cool project too.
You came away with any more open heart insights to Brahms from this lovely friend, because friendship was so important to him.
Mm-hmm. I think so. I mean, for me, I respect Brahms even more having done this project because, you know, I've always loved his music. I love his cello sonatas, naturally, piano quartets, piano quintet. But this, the fact that he was really out, you know, he stepped outside of himself to write for instruments he wasn't comfortable playing himself, and share and put his deepest thoughts in there, his loss of his love. It's all in there. It's amazing that he was so generous to share with all of us.
Cellist Jennifer Kletzel, a member of the esteemed Cypress String Quartet with Cicely Ward and Tom Stone violins and Ethan Filner viola, speaking with us about this recording. The Cypress String Quartet will seal their 20-year history with this last recording featuring the two string sextets by Brahms. They have been joined by longtime collaborators and friends, violist Barry Schiffman and cellist Zool Bailey. The album was recently released on AV Records, AVIE Records, and it was recorded live in front of a studio audience at Skywalker Sound Studio. For more information on the web, CypressQuartet.com, CypressQuartet.com. The string sextets in B-flat, opus 18, number 1, and string sextet number 2 in G major, opus 36. The Cypress String Quartet bringing to a close 20 years of performing together with this Brahms recording.